at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more die, but I ain't a merchant anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a merchant anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't a merchant anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning,
you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. Today's episode honors veteran journalist Glenn Ford, who passed away in July 2021. As reported by News One, Glenn Ford spent more than four decades delivering the news from a Black perspective on a national scale. Today, we share excerpts from a speech Ford gave to the Grassroots Radio Conference in 2019 in Rochester, New York, entitled Information for Liberation, the History of Black Radio News. Introducing him is the conference host, Rashida Birch Washington of WXIR Rochester.
Now, for those of you who are not very familiar with Glenn, I just want to share a little bit about him. Historic first, most, and onlys are the hallmarks of Glenn Ford's long career. The son of a famed disc jockey named Rudy the Deuce Rutherford, the first Black man to host a non-gospel television show in the Deep South in Columbus, Georgia, 1958, Glenn was reading Newswire copy on the air at age 11. Glenn's first full-time broadcast news job was at James Brown's Augusta, Georgia radio station, WRDW, in 1970, where the godfather of soul shortened Glenn's surname to Ford. Glenn Ford worked as a newsperson at four more local stations in Columbus, Georgia, Atlanta, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. in 1974. In 1977, Ford co-launched and produced and hosted America's Black Forum, ABF, the first nationally syndicated Black news interview program on commercial television. Now, in the fall of 2006, Glenn Ford, Bruce Dixon, Margaret Kimberly, and Letitia Stills launched Black Agenda Report, which you can visit at blackagendareport.com. And so I'm very pleased to welcome to the Grassroots Radio Conference and to Rochester, New York, Mr. Glenn Ford.
Power to the people. What is the power of news? The news person acting as an editor, and every news person acts as an editor of a kind, decides what is important among the many events of the day. And he or she decides who are the most relevant people and the most relevant institutions to discuss those events of the day. News people decide who the credible sources are who are going to interpret these events of the day. News people decide who the key players are in the political arena, and they decide that by repeatedly calling on these particular players for comments about and in the news. That means that news people decide who the leaders of society are, because if someone is constantly called upon and put into the news, then the people assume that those people must be the leaders of something. Now, of course, if you are reading somebody else's copy, if you are playing some corporate news feed, then you are allowing other people to decide what the issues and events that are most important are and who is qualified to speak on those issues. Therefore, you are allowing those other people to decide who the leaders of society are. It goes with the game. I want to talk to you very seriously about Black radio news, and that is the door that I walked through about half a century ago. Black radio news was once a very powerful tool that, if wielded correctly, could function as both a magnifier and an incubator of grassroots political movements. In fact, Black radio news was birthed by the Black mass movement of the 60s. It is a child of that movement and cannot be understood outside of that movement. Black radio news did not exist as a national force and a national institution before the great mass movement of the 60s. And it faded and went damn near extinct following the dismantling of that Black mass movement. Black radio news is therefore inseparable from the fortunes of the Black mass movement, the movement that brought it into existence. In 1958, when my father got back to Georgia, and in 1961, when as an 11-year-old I started reading the news, there had already been, of course, ongoing civil rights movement activity in various places. There, of course, were lunch counter sit-ins and all kinds of direct action experiments trying to figure out how we're going to upset this Jim Crow. But there was not, at that time, anything that we could call a mass movement. This was 2 years before the 63 March on Washington. It was 4 years before Black folks really kicked it off by burning down the Watts section of Los Angeles in 1965. So the civil rights movement wave had not hit. But when it did hit around 1965, it felt like a wave of consciousness, a wave that roiled people. And once Black folks started shaking up the country and started scaring white people and shouting down the man and arguing very loudly and publicly among themselves about something that they were calling liberation, using that word to accent the purpose of the movement, well, accompanying that was a demand for news. We must remember that in the year 1965, there were 10,000 separate demonstrations. Those people, the public at large, whether they were involved in these demonstrations or not, wanted to hear about them. They were demanding news. I'm talking about black people demanding news from the stations that they listened to. And they wanted to hear that news from other black people because that was the only source that they were going to trust during this period of mass movement activity. Researchers estimate that by about 1966, there were, they think, about 100 black radio stations. By the time I got out of the Army in 1970, I estimate that there were at least 180 black-oriented radio stations. That phenomenal growth was directly related. It was, in fact, caused by the mass movement that had marked the 1960s. And white money, investor money, responded to that movement by purchasing and establishing, rather, black radio stations. This was not a phenomenon of black ownership. James Brown, in 1970, was the radio station king. He had more radio stations than any other black person. Three, one in Augusta, one in Knoxville, Tennessee, and one in Baltimore. This phenomenon of the explosion of black radio was a white investor and black folk affair. Virtually every top 50 black radio market had at least one black radio station. Many had several, but even small but heavily black cities and towns were likely to have a radio station. And if there was a radio station there, it was likely that they had a full-time newsman. All of this had happened so quickly. At the beginning of the decade, we saw a configuration that changed utterly by the end of the decade. There were suddenly hundreds of young people who were acting as journalists on radio. And although not all of them were radical like me, many of them were. And there was a culture, maybe it was a subculture, in black radio news of purposeful and very conscious radicality, that we were spreading information for liberation. And nobody was there with some kind of textbook to describe what black news is. And so we wrote that book ourselves. We decided how a black person in this new age was supposed to comport themselves on radio as a journalist. We wrote those rules. And we, for a time, had the right, the privilege, the liberty, the license to write those rules because we had a movement behind us that had called upon us to do this kind of work. In the early 70s, 90% of the black population listened to the local black station. And that made these stations very, very attractive to investors. Advertisers were still blatantly discriminating against black radio, and they got away with that. But still, because black listeners were so, and remain, so loyal to black radio, and there were so many non-black stations in any given market, black radio stations served a disproportionately large segment of the market. So they were in a strategically good position, although they were cheated every day by advertisers of a good rate. Before there was hip-hop, young people and older people listened to the same station, and the only outlier was the God people, and they'd listen to the local gospel station. And that made the black radio station even more important, especially politically, in that the young folks who are the most volatile politically and the older folks who actually vote were listening to the same messages. So the political importance of these black radio stations was really immense. Black radio's audience was the whole community, and the whole community wanted their reporters, the ones they heard every day, to reveal to them who was on their side in struggle and who was worthy of support. So when I got my first salaried job after leaving the Army, and that was again in January 1970 at James Brown's radio station in Augusta, Georgia, there was no question that my mission was to shake up that city thoroughly. But also, I didn't have any idea how I was going to do that, because that was my first job. I did know something, and that was that Augusta was a backwater. I knew that because Columbus, Georgia was very much like it. It's on the other side of the state. It was a backwater, too. The mass movement of the 60s had hardly touched Augusta, Georgia, and it hadn't touched Columbus, Georgia either. Although people there had vicariously experienced the movement through the media. Augusta was a half black city, but it didn't even have one black city councilman. These were the cities, along with Macon, along with Savannah, that Dr. Martin Luther King had been prevented from coming into by the local racist power structure, backed up by the black clergy. What folks, most people don't understand is that although the SCLC was considered a rump renegade section of the black clergy, Dr. King still adhered to the protocols of good Baptists. And he would not go into a city unless there was an invitation from another minister. You didn't just roll into a city uninvited and set up shop. But the fact was that throughout Georgia, and in fact throughout the South, most cities, ministers were adamant that Dr. King not come in. Their attitude was, we can handle our relations with the white folk. We don't need any outside people coming in here and roiling things up. The fact of the matter is that the preaching class had been collaborating with the white power structure all along. And so when you study up on Dr. King, you will see that his itinerary was actually dictated by those few places in which he could gain entrance because of an invitation. And in Georgia, that was just in the smaller city of Albany, because some preachers were fighting among themselves. And as part of their fight, one of them called in Dr. King. And then they hooked up with the students at the black college in Albany. And the same thing happened in Florida, where he was allowed to come into St. Augustine and basically nowhere else because of a dispute between preachers, one of whom pulled the trump card of Dr. King. But otherwise, he was locked out of these places. So Columbus was one, and Macon was one, and certainly Augusta was one. And I did understand that when I came into Augusta, Georgia. When I got there, it was still the dark of night, and the news director settled me in. He said, Glenn, there's your microphone and there's your recording equipment. And oh, by the way, your name is Ford. They like monosyllable names in radio. So I was no longer Glenn Rutherford, I was Glenn Ford. And then he pointed to the wall and there was a piece of paper taped to the wall. And he said, that's a list of all of the big black folks in town. And so whenever you need comment on a story that comes across the newswire, call one of those guys. I said, okay, and he left. And as soon as he left, I went to the list to see who all these important black folks were. And the first one was Reverend this, and the second was Reverend Doctor, and the third one was Bishop that, and the whole list was a theocracy. Every single one of them were clergymen. And I was enraged. I was not about to further empower these people who had been collaborating with the racist power structure all of this time. And so I ripped the list off the wall and crumbled it up and threw it into the wastebasket. And I spent the next week immersing myself in the real Augusta. I wanted to find the real leaders of Black Augusta, since Black Augusta had no other leadership visible except these Black clergymen whose list I had discarded. And the first thing I did was go into the public housing projects, because I knew that in there was a rather loud Black woman who all of the other tenants respected and listened to. And I knew that I would find her because she's always there, and I did. And she became my contact person on housing and poor people's issues in general. And next, I went looking for that brother who jumps up every time the police beat down another brother. And he's always there, and I found him rather quickly too. And he became my contact person on issues of criminal justice. And the next item on the list was to find that Black businessman who's so frustrated and tells everybody about how the city and the county never give Black people contracts. And he, of course, was there too, and I found him quickly. And he became my economic development person. And then I went looking for the even more easy to find, frustrated Black educator who's sick and tired of butting her head against the Jim Crow educational system, and I found that person too, and that became my person on education, and so on and so forth for that brief period of time, until I finally had about 7 or 8 people who I would treat as leaders. And I called them my committee of 10, even though there were only about 7 or 8. And each and every newscast that I did had one or more of these people commenting on the news and very quickly making demands for change. It what really got to me was that in no time, these people didn't need any coaching or prodding from me. They grew quickly, almost instantaneously, into the job of public leaders rather than street leaders. And that's because they really were leaders all along. In a little over a week, it was after I'd brought them on, it was clear to me that even though James Brown was only paying me $70 a week, which is like $50 after taxes, and he made you wear a suit and a tie, and I just got out the army and I didn't have a suit and a tie. Even though this was enforced poverty and very long hours and a boss that I truly did not like, I was hooked. Because I had discovered that with this microphone, I could change the political complexion of a medium size city, and then move on to bigger things in terms of social transformation. That was my education. After a couple of weeks, I asked the committee of 10 what the big project was going to be. How are we going to really tackle these people? And they thought about it. I didn't have anything to do with it. They thought about it and shortly came back to me, and they decided that what was needed was a boycott of downtown businesses. Augusta, Georgia, like lots of cities in that region, the downtown shopping district was populated overwhelmingly by Black shoppers, but most of the businesses there would not employ Blacks on the floor. At least. What they were proposing was a don't shop where you can't work campaign, like Adam Clayton Powell Sr. and his son, Adam, used to run in Harlem in the 30s and 40s. And this is the 1970s, but that's how backward, how far back, what a backwater Augusta, Georgia was. And so that's what they wanted, and that's what we launched. And we launched it on radio station WRDW. When we put it out there, the community responded with tremendous, tremendous enthusiasm. It was like an awakening of that Augusta Black community. In fact, the enthusiasm was so general and so intense that some of those preachers who were on the list that I had thrown away and discarded joined the movement to boycott the downtown businesses, and I had to put them back on the radio. And I was glad to do it. That was the test that was needed, and some of them passed that test. And one of them had one of the biggest churches in town. And I'd been in touch with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Atlanta during this whole process. So I put the good preacher in touch with the SCLC, and his church was set for the event on the eve of the beginning of the boycott, the big event starring the SCLC and him. And on that night, that church was full to the rafters, and there were several hundred people who were waiting around outside. And the high point, as far as most of the crowd was concerned, was when James Brown sent word that he was flying in on his black jet. James Brown had a Learjet, a rented Learjet, that he painted black. And whenever he would come into town, red lights would go off in the station, and a sound effect would go roll, roll, roll. And a disc jockey was required to go on the air and say, "The black jet is about to arrive, James Brown." You know, so he had one of his minions announce that he was coming in, and he was going to contribute $600 to a bail fund in case anybody went to jail. And the crowd just, they went wild because James Brown was their most famous son, and they all listened to his radio station. And here he was on the people's side, and they were just overjoyed. Everybody was happy in that church that night except me, because I knew something was up. And something was up because I knew that most of James Brown's biggest advertisers were those downtown merchants. And the question had always been, how is Mr. Brown going to react to this? But they were happy that night. And the next morning, I went in to work and got there at 6 o'clock in the morning, as usual, and sat down to do the first newscast. I was already with it, with sound, you dig, of Augusta, Georgia's first mass movement event. But on the microphone was a note taped that said, "There will be no coverage of the downtown merchants boycott on this radio station." And it crushed me. And so, I didn't do any news. I just refused to do it. This is the news. How can I do a newscast when you said I can't do the news? This is the biggest news that has ever hit Augusta, Georgia, and I can't do it, so I guess there's no news. But I knew that James Brown was coming in. Folks told me that he wanted to talk to me. We had our talk. The station manager grabbed me, and the program director grabbed him to prevent us from coming up to blows, which was very fortunate for me because James Brown could have kicked my ass. He was a hell of an athlete on stage and had been a boxer. But it was decided that, yes, I should leave. And I got my severance pay and went back to New Jersey. But I kept up with what was happening in Augusta. The boycott, the planning of it, had been so dependent upon the cooperation of the radio station, you know, me, to succeed. That fell through, it collapsed. But the Committee of 10, they were an entity now. They were about making a movement. And so they focused on, guess what? Criminal justice, of course. And so about 6 weeks after I left, I found that they had tried to organize a march through downtown Augusta. The mayor ordered his police to stop it. The police blocked the way. The marchers kept on coming, and the police fired on the crowd. And what followed was what they call the Augusta riot, Rebellion of 1970, in which several people were killed, and the racist governor, Lester Maddox, flew in. He was accompanied by James Brown doing his accommodationist, collaborationist bit to tamp down the rebellion. Now, I wasn't there for the Augusta Rebellion, but I claim it as mine, because it would not have happened had I not set foot there and had there not been Black radio news.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to a speech on the power of Black radio news given by the recently departed veteran journalist Glenn Ford. Special thanks to Rashida Birch Washington of WXIR Radio in Rochester, New York, for giving us permission to share Ford's speech, which was given at the 2019 Grassroots Radio Conference. You can hear the complete speech at Mixcloud by doing a search with the words Information for Liberation. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Stephanie Schubert with Pacifica Network. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
Welcome to Film at 11 here on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Today we have another Western, some rediscoveries, but first, let's hear from Jeff Godsall on Sideways.
The films of Alexander Payne are often populated with characters that could charitably be called flawed. Morally compromised might be a better term.